in this big storm of shame and bad feelings, there I could pick out one thing that was gender dysphoria. Once that became clear, my relationship with self-harm changed a little bit as well. I was still cutting for the same reasons, but the location of where I would self-harm started to be more on the areas that are typically associated with femininity, so like my chest or my hips.
Welcome to the Psychology of Self-Injury podcast, a resource for parents, professionals, and people with lived experience. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Westers, clinical psychologist at Children's Health, associate professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, and chair of the Media and Communications Committee of the International Society for the Study of Self-Injury, or ISSS, or simply ISSS. Back in Season 1, we did an episode with Dr. Lindsay Taliaferro on self-injury among sexual and gender minorities. It still moves my heart to know that approximately 47% of transgender adults and 56% of transgender and non-binary youth report having engaged in non-suicidal self-injury, or NSSI for short. And it's easy to cite these statistics, numbers, and alphabet soups like LGBTQ, but it's a whole different thing to put a face, or a voice in this case, to the experience of a real human being that many people are quick to otherwise marginalize. This is one of the many reasons I like to include interviews with those with lived experience of self-injury on this podcast, and this is one reason I wanted to interview Thomas, a real human being with a truly kind heart who is also transgender. Thomas expressed interest in being interviewed by filling out the form in Google Docs that's linked to the end of every new episode notes. It's also not just for those with lived experience of self-injury. He wrote, "My reasons for self-injury have changed over the course of my life, but one reason that has stayed relatively constant is an internal desire to dissociate from my body. For many transgender people, myself included, self-injury can be a way to momentarily escape from our bodies, or as a reaction to transphobia-induced shame. It's a unique experience that I believe clinicians can benefit from, and that other trans people with lived experience can relate to." I agreed. Thomas is a transgender man from Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada, uses he and they pronouns, recently earned a bachelor's degree in psychology, and has a passion for community advocacy and peer support. For the last 8 years, Thomas has volunteered for and co-facilitated local peer support groups designed to empower his local transgender community through their own journeys of self-discovery and community building. He dreams of one day becoming a counseling psychologist specializing in transgender mental health care so they can give back to the community that has helped him through his own gender transition and mental health struggles to become who he is today. Thomas is an avid collector of tattoos, weird cross-stitch patterns, even weirder music, and anything that smells nice. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Thomas.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate Past Thomas for writing that bio. That was good.
Well, I wanted to ask to start things off what it was that you had done that was a form of self-injury. Here we are talking about your lived experience. When did it start? What was it that you did using general terms and how people responded?
Initially, so across my whole kind of experience with self-harm, I've cut myself mostly, but in particular moments of really strong rage or anger towards myself, I'd also sometimes hit myself in the head or just hurt other parts of my body, just hitting them as opposed to cutting them sometimes. That was used specifically for when I was feeling really, really angry at myself or something. In terms of when my self-harm started and kind of how it kind of morphed into a real problem, my first memory of when I first self-harmed was when I was 12 years old. The context was that I didn't want to run the mile in gym class, so I hid behind the bleachers with my friend, and I took rocks on the ground and I dragged them across the skin on my legs. And I remember really liking the like white outline that it made on your skin. And over the course of several years, it kind of just morphed into this way that I cope with overwhelming feelings that I was having, which were a lot at the time, because there was a lot of really big life changes that I was going through at the time. Like my parents were divorcing and divorced. And as a result of that divorce, my dad moved my brothers and me to a totally new country where we started a new school. And this was all very far away from my mom as well. And so dealing with that separation of me from my own mom and then starting a new school, a new family dynamic with my stepmother and her kids, it was all very, very stressful. And I didn't really know what to do with all of these feelings that I had because I wasn't ever taught really how to handle emotions or how to process emotions. And so that came out through cutting, basically.
And that was when you were 12 that you moved and you had started self-injuring?
Exactly. Yeah, I was 12 years old. And so over the course of the next several years until I was about 19 or so, that was my primary way of handling these emotions. And there were a bunch of other factors that kind of led into that as well. So over time, I had kind of learned, I guess you can say learned, that self-injury cutting specifically, it allowed me to like disappear temporarily from myself. Because at the time, from when I was 12 until 19 or 20 years old, it just felt really bad to be in my body. Both, I didn't realize it at the time for gender dysphoria reasons, but also just because the way that I was raised and the particular, I guess, disciplinary tactics that my family used involved a lot of manual labor, I guess you could say. So I was often using my body to do things that just felt really bad and kind of filled me with stress and embarrassment and humiliation for having to do these things in the first place. So that combined with shame of not feeling loved or wanted by my family, mixed with this weird nebulous gender dysphoria feeling, kind of just all amalgamated into this giant ugly ball of bad feelings of you're a bad person. Self-injury kind of allowed me, or cutting allowed me, to deal with those emotions that I otherwise didn't know how to deal with.
Did your parents ever find out about your self-injury?
They did, yeah. My parents did know about my self-injury while I was doing it pretty much the entire time that I was living with them. To be honest, I don't really remember us talking about it or addressing it in a way to where I didn't feel like supremely embarrassed about it afterwards. But they did some things to show that, you know, it was something that was on their mind, that they weren't completely oblivious to the fact that it was happening. They also knew that I was struggling with my mental health as well. So, for example, like I went to see a psychiatrist and I was put on a few different meds that were supposed to help with my self-harm urges, things like that. I mean, they were doing the best with what they knew at the time. They also made sure that I wasn't ever around, or that there wasn't ever available like sharp knives or shaving razors, things like that. At one point, they just didn't really know how to help me or what to do. And so they took me to a youth psychiatric facility and they said, okay, maybe you just stay there for a week. Maybe something will happen. And to be honest, I didn't really feel all that supported by them emotionally. I felt supported by them in the sense that I knew that I had a roof over my head and I knew that I had a place to live and food to eat, things like that. But I didn't experience really any kind of emotional, I love you kind of support from them, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know for a lot of parents, not knowing what to do, their way of showing that love is to get them to a treatment facility like the one you went to, yeah, even if it doesn't come across as love.
Yeah. I kind of view them as, you know, they are view it as they were faced with a somewhat extreme situation, especially given that I was the only one in our family who was engaging in this kind of behavior. They didn't know what to do. They had all the books they had written on raising kids didn't really address this. And so they just did the best with what they had at the time. At the same time, I didn't necessarily feel supported by them, but, you know, I've forgiven them for that, but that's still did have an impact on me at the time.
Yeah, that was your experience as a teenager, as an adolescent. Yeah. You went to an inpatient program, and most people who self-injure, they don't necessarily need an inpatient program like that. Those are often reserved for those who are suicidal or have attempted suicide or engage in really severe forms of self-injury. So were suicidal thoughts part of your experience?
At the time, yes, it was. I guess I want to differentiate between the self-harm that I was engaging in when I was 12 to 19, and then from like 20 onward. The 12 to 19 age range was a period of really acute self-injury in the sense that I wasn't ever at risk of becoming seriously, seriously injured or having to be hospitalized for my self-injury. But there was also accompanying that self-injury a lot of feelings of wanting to die, of suicidality, of just a shame that was so intense that I could like tangibly feel it in my body kind of deal. Me going to the psychiatric facility kind of came about when I was at school and I had given one of my teachers that I had trusted a note, a little piece of paper. And I remember what it says still on the paper. It said, "I really want to hurt myself and I don't know what to do." And so I left that for my teacher. And of course, she was kind of freaked out a little bit. And so my teacher gave the note to the guidance counselor. The guidance counselor called me in, said, "What's going on?" Called my dad from work. And then from there, my dad took me to the psychiatric hospital from there. And because there was quite a concern that I was going to act on these suicidal ideations that I was having at the time.
So were you differentiating that from the cutting? The suicidal thoughts, were they separate from the cutting, or was that the thought that you had of attempting suicide?
My self-harm wasn't in an attempt to kill myself, but the self-injury and the suicidal thoughts were occurring at the same time, but they weren't necessarily related to each other in that when I cut myself, I was trying to kill myself. That wasn't the case, no.
I ask that because a lot of people still misconstrue non-suicidal self-injury with suicide and they treat it as the same. But self-injury is a risk factor for attempting suicide, and they can oftentimes co-occur. Suicidal thoughts, that is, can often co-occur with non-suicidal self-injury, even though they're not the same and shouldn't be treated as such. So I wanted to get your experience and see if that rang true for you.
Yeah, no, and that is a really good distinction to make, because you're right, there is this difference, and sometimes they're connected, but sometimes they're not. And it's really important to, you know, if you're working with somebody, to gauge like where they're at with that dynamic as well.
Well, I know some teachers listen to this podcast, and hearing you share that you gave this note to your teacher, she got you to the guidance counselor, you end up in an inpatient program. I imagine you returned to school at some point after that. What was your relationship with that teacher like after?
It was good, because I trusted that teacher to still have this positive regard for me. I knew that she still thought that I was, you know, a good student, that I was a good kid, that she had this positive relationship with me. And that didn't change when I came back to school. If anything, she wanted to make sure that I was okay, but not in a coddling kind of way. I knew that she was concerned about me and that she had this concern for me, but it didn't overshadow. It didn't make me feel like I stuck out in some way, if that makes sense. She was kind of like a second mom in a way. And I know that's a hard role to fill for somebody's life, especially if, you know, they're just one of your students. But I think this one person was very special in that regard. And so I really appreciated her role in my life at that time.
And is that how your dad and how your parents found out about the self-injury, is through that teacher?
No, they had known about my self-injury from before then. It's just that I don't think my parents realized how much I was suffering at the time, because I mentioned that there were a lot of different factors that came into play as to why my parents may not have been aware of just how much I was going through, in the sense that very often I was isolated as a kid, to where I didn't really hang out with friends. And I spent a lot of time in my room, not necessarily by my own choice, but again, by the kind of disciplinary tactics that my family had when I was growing up, to where if you had gotten in trouble for something, which could be anything really, that you were banished to your room and you weren't allowed to leave or come out. And so self-harm turned into this way that I could deal with these intense emotions that I wasn't able to talk to my family about. I felt very alone in having these emotions. And it was a way that I could deal with emotions that was a solo activity. It was theoretically easy to hide, and it flooded me with a bunch of endorphins. And so it became this, you know, addictive cycle, and that the more I cut, the more I needed to cut. What I was struggling with and the mental health struggles I was having really only became noticeable to them when the self-harm started getting much, much worse. It became much more noticeable.
So it wasn't like they were sending you to your room because you were self-injuring?
No. Okay. That was for various other things that I was doing or not doing that I didn't quite understand, but yeah.
Well, you also mentioned seeking out medication for self-injury. Did you find that helpful?
I didn't really find it all that helpful, in the sense that, I mean, it did help a tiny bit, in the sense that the medication that I was on, I think it was called Lamictal. I don't know if that's been used in the past to help with self-harm urges for other people, but that's why I was put on it specifically. because it was supposed to help with cravings for whatever you happen to be struggling with or addicted to. And I found it did help a little bit in the sense that I didn't have a craving, so to speak, for self-injury, but that didn't really translate over to mean stopping cutting. It just became more of a, oh, this is just a habit that I do now. This is just part of this nightly ritual that I do so I can feel some sense of control over my day and over my time, along with dealing with these emotions too.
We have not done a podcast episode on this, but some people will ask about what medications are there for self-injury. And the quick answer is there isn't one. One reason we haven't done a podcast episode on this, in the past, there was one called naltrexone that's still used today that helps block the opioid function of the self-injury. So you wouldn't necessarily get that relief and maybe be discouraged as a result from using self-injury. But most medications that people would suggest for self-injury target emotion regulation, such as Lamictal or an antidepressant medications, mood stabilizers that address the context in which the self-injury occurs, but doesn't directly address the self-injury.
Exactly. Especially if you turn to self-injury or cutting or whatever you happen to be doing, if there's an association in your brain to where bad feelings, cut yourself, it doesn't do anything with that. It just mood stabilizers, right?
Yeah. You had mentioned that the self-injury from ages 12 to 19 was different from 20 onward. Can you talk a little bit more about the differences there?
When I was in my 20s, and for context, I'm 31, so it's been a few years. When I was in my 20s is when I really started to notice that in this big storm of shame and bad feelings, there I could pick out one thing that was gender dysphoria, that was incongruence with the way that I was being treated versus how I felt on the inside in regards to gender. Once that became clear, once that part of that shame became, you know, noticeable, its own little entity, so to speak, my relationship with self-harm changed a little bit as well. I was still cutting for the same reasons, in the sense that I still wanted to, you know, escape from myself. I still had all this other shame that I wanted to deal with. But the location of where I would self-harm started to be more on the areas that are typically associated with femininity. So like my chest or my hips. And at the time, those parts of my body kind of represented not only the source of, but the target of these feelings of, you know, you're going to feel wrong or incorrect and like tragically disconnected from your sense of self and your body for the rest of your life. And there's nothing you can do about it, like that kind of anxiety. And so I didn't really know how to deal with that dread of having to live the rest of my life as a woman specifically, not just as a person, but to feel forced to assume this role of daughter or girlfriend or woman in particular. I didn't necessarily want to like punish my body for being the wrong quote unquote body. It wasn't that I hated my body, but self-harm at the end of the day for me, it was a way to escape from myself. And that self includes my physical body as well. I wanted to fly away, escape from Planet Thomas, so to speak, and just kind of be in my own head. And cutting was an old favorite, so to speak, among the many different forms of self-harm that I was engaging in at the time. Cutting just happened to be the free one, and the other ones were a little more expensive. So that's kind of how my self-harm, my relationship to it, and the way that I engaged in it changed once I became aware that I was actually transgender.
And when did you become aware?
When I was 26 is when I really started to be like, oh, I have to do something about this. So.
How long were you questioning that? Was it starting at 26, or was that when you just came to the realization?
That's when I just came to the realization that I was transgender. I had been feeling what I now understand as gender dysphoria ever since I was 12, 13 years old, ever since I started to develop basically secondary sex characteristics. But at the time, I didn't know that that's what it was, because I didn't know any trans people. I had never seen any representation or any exposure to trans people, not even in a good way or in a bad way. It was not a thing in my life at all. And so I had these kind of nebulous feelings of just bad towards these parts of my body. But I didn't know why. I didn't know what I didn't know. Like I said, it just kind of all went together into this big bad feeling. But it was when I was like 25 to 26 is when I started to be like, oh, this is specifically what this feeling is. And here's how specifically how it applies to these specific parts of my body. And then from there, I was able to frantically look on the internet. Why do I feel bad about my hips? Is that weird? And then other people talking about the same things came up. And long story short, that's how I realized that I was not a cisgender person.
So you have been questioning for some 14 years.
Exactly.
Figuring out this doesn't feel right. At what point were you self-injuring your chest and hips in those areas?
That was starting in my, kind of when I went to college, around 18, 19 years old. It wasn't that when I was 18, 19 years old that I definitively said, I am transgender. But that's when I started noticing that, oh, these bad feelings that I have, part of that is specifically towards these parts of my bodies that represent femininity, represent this sense that you are a woman.
I like how you articulated earlier that it wasn't so much that you hated those parts of your body and needed to be punished or harmed, because I know there are some individuals, trans individuals, who feel that way. In your case, it was more being able to cope or disconnect from that femininity.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And you're absolutely right that there are a lot of trans people who do feel this tangible disconnect from these parts of their body because they represent something that is not who they are. And so if they also self-harm, maybe they do that for a different reason. But for me, I guess it was the parts of myself represent femininity. Also, I want to escape from my body. In a weird way, it was kind of like killing two birds with one stone almost in a way. I don't know if that made sense, but. And they were relatively easy places to hide too, because I wasn't showing these parts of my body to anybody. My arms would be clear. My legs would be clear. I could still self-harm in a way that was very easily hideable. And that was part of the intentional choice to self-harm on my chest and my hips as well.
How frequent were you doing this?
It was almost like an everyday thing. And if I didn't cut or self-harm on that one day, I was picking at scabs, which is just another form of self-harm as well. Yeah, it was an almost everyday thing.
And so at 26, you then realized, okay, I'm a trans man. Then what changed?
So when I was 26 is when I started hormone replacement therapy. I started testosterone. And that, it was kind of the turning point for not just the start of my transition and taking this big step that I'd been kind of daydreaming about taking for a long time. But it also started that journey of me changing the way that I related to my own body and by extension, my sense of self as well. Starting hormone replacement therapy and also attending peer support groups for other transgender people who were in this similar process of transitioning, questioning their gender, trying to figure out who am I? Like, how do I relate to myself as a person when I have all these feelings that tell me that I am different somehow and nobody else is feeling this way, you know? Through those groups, I was able to better understand that my core self as a person, the self that exists behind my physical body, the self that really houses who I actually am. And so therefore, I could hold on to that part of me while my outer body changed as well, was going through these changes. And so that helped me cope with the changes that I was experiencing as a part of my transition, but also it helped me become more secure with my sense of self as a person, like I said. And then I didn't really feel as much shame about myself. And so then self-harm kind of started to go away too, because I was becoming more familiar with myself, with who I wanted to be, with the kind of person, the kind of space that I wanted to take up in this world. And so I didn't really feel a need to take out all these negative feelings on my own self, if that makes sense, via cutting. That relationship that I have with that inner self of myself has exponentially been getting stronger and stronger to where I don't even really cut myself at all anymore. So yeah, I know that that phrase gets thrown around a lot, that gender affirming care saves lives, but I'm living proof that it really genuinely does in a way that is difficult to quantify.
Can you talk a little bit more about that last comment, that it saves lives, and your living testimony of that?
Yeah. So again, I'm not speaking for the entire trans community. I feel like that's just a disclaimer that I should put in front of anything that I say from now on. But when a person realizes that they're trans before they transition, there's a lot of trans people who are experiencing some very negative, very painful feelings about not just their physical body, but about their role in society. The expectations that other people have of them as this gender, as a man or as a woman. And so that disconnect from how I feel inside of myself and who I desperately want other people to see me as versus the reality of how people see me or what people see me as, that disconnect can be very, very strong and very, very painful. And so sometimes that pain comes out, especially if the person has a history of self-injury, it comes out through that coping skill. That can be really devastating for a person and for their family as well, who, one, are trying to help their person who is self-harming or cutting, and then two, this other additional layer of gender dysphoria or things like that. And it's all just very confusing for other people to try to help another person with, because it's all a very internal experience, right? There can be a lot of confusion as to how to help people in those situations. And so when a person has access to gender-affirming care, to mental health support that affirms their gender, that says to them in multiple ways, who you believe you are is actually who you are. You are correct in what you believe about yourself, in how you feel about yourself, and we want you to have that sense of autonomy over your own self and your own body. That is priceless. There's no substitute for that feeling. And so when somebody is afforded those opportunities, all of a sudden, they have hope for their future. They have hope that they could live a fulfilling life that is filled with being okay with yourself in more than just a emotional self-esteem kind of way. And so, of course, when you're feeling good about yourself and you're feeling good about your life and good about your prospects, I would hope that one's self-harm or self-injury tends to decrease because they have more self-esteem and they have more hope for their future. And they know that they have the energy to engage in other healthier coping mechanisms as well. So gender-affirming care, it really could take somebody from wanting to die to wanting to live in a very, and not a lot of things are very black and white, but I think, and it's not like transitioning, you know, solves all of your problems, but it'll solve a really big one. And for trans people who transition, it takes them to being able to deal with life. The way that I kind of describe it is it's a lot easier to deal with your life when you're starting at zero as opposed to negative 100. Yeah, it really does save lives in multiple ways, in multiple manifestations.
Well, I know the very little research that there is out there on non-suicidal self-injury among transgender individuals has shown that about half of transgender individuals have self-injured or have a history of self-injury, including within the past year, and 40% report having self-injured 10 or more times in the past year. So we're talking 2 out of 5 individuals who are transgender self-injuring quite often, and a large number of them. I know in the general population of cisgender individuals in our community, at least here in the United States, I'm not sure how it is necessarily in Canada, but there is a lot of pushback against that for, you know, the black and whites, like either you're male or female, but even just simply using preferred pronouns and preferred names. If they said, oh, my name is Jonathan, please call me John. Okay, I'm going to call them John. I'm not going to look at their birth certificate, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. Yeah.
Especially if I know that's a good social skill to have as a person, to be able to just call someone by their name, even if it's an odd name or it's a hard one to pronounce. You know, I try to practice those difficult names to pronounce. Some struggle with using different pronouns. So the they, them pronouns, I think, really is a struggle for some people because our brains often tend to categorize things as, you know, yes, no, he, her. And so to introduce the plural third person pronoun, them, they, it can be really hard and to make that adjustment. What are your thoughts on that?
I can understand how it would be difficult to use it intentionally for a singular person, but I will point to the fact that we do use they and them to refer to singular people all the time when we don't know the person. So like, for example, if we find a pair of keys on the ground, just randomly, we'll say, oh, I wonder whose keys those are. I hope they come back for them. Or I hope that they find their keys. So like we use they, them pronouns for singular people all the time. And it's not even like a new thing that just started happening. Like Shakespeare, Emily Bronte, all these different poets, they use they, them pronouns to refer to singular people as well. So this is definitely not a new concept, but I think what the difficulty comes from when individuals say, I would like you to use those pronouns for me specifically and not just incidentally when you don't know the person or don't know how else to refer to them. And I think that's where the difficulty for a lot of people comes from, because you're exactly right. Normally, when we do refer to somebody and we know who they are or we know how they present anyway, our automatic assumption is to default to he or she. But really, all it takes is just a little bit of switching your mindset when you're referring to an individual person who you know with they and them pronouns. The grammar is good. The grammar is fine. There's nothing grammatically incorrect about it. It's just having to shift our perspective of how we relate to this person, of how the place in our mind that this person takes up. Whereas before, it may be they took up the space of he, when now we have to kind of switch a little bit to associate this person with they and them. Despite there being maybe no changes in how they present themselves, they still might present themselves as very masculine or very feminine or what have you. And for some people, it takes a little bit of time and a little bit of practice to just switch over to they and them. But it is very doable. It is possible. It just takes a little bit of practice and a little bit of just switching that mindset a little bit.
Back in season one, I had interviewed Dr. Lindsay Taliaferro about non-suicidal self-injury among LGBTQ individuals. And the focus for that episode was predominantly lesbian, gay, bisexual, as opposed to transgender. I just revealed the statistics about half of all transgender individuals reporting self-injury, and even in the past year, so a high prevalence. One of her key points in that episode is that it's not necessarily something inherently different about those individuals that leads them to self-injure more frequently, but the environment in which they find themselves and the experiences that they have. So I'm wondering for you, if your environment, whether it was as an adolescent or late 20s when you were transitioning, if your experiences with people that disagree with transgender as a construct even had any effect on your self-injury.
I've been very privileged in the sense that my transition has been pretty comparatively very easy. I come across as an able-bodied white guy, so I kind of have all the privilege in the world in that respect. But there are other transgender people who don't have those same privileges that I do. And as a result of my own status, I didn't really experience that much overt transphobia. I did, when I was in the middle of my transition and I was fulfilling a very androgynous, ambiguous space, there were a lot of people who would just straight up ask me, are you a man or a woman? And it's not really a question you typically hear from people. So I kind of had to develop a series of canned responses that I would say back that would not answer their question and would kind of gently say, maybe you should think about why you're asking me that question in the first place. So my favorite one was, I don't see how this is relevant to our conversation, and just kind of continue on with what we were talking about before. Like I was saying, it has not been that easy for many, many, many other trans people as well, to where they will often feel physically threatened and afraid of their own life because of the transphobia that they experience. Because there's not a lot of safe places to talk about those feelings, especially in regards to that intersection with being transgender, there's nowhere for those feelings really to go. And so it would come out as cutting yourself, among other things, I'm sure. So, and that really, I think, speaks to that important aspect of community, of having people to talk to about cutting yourself, about what it's like to be transgender, what it's like to experience transphobia, how we handle transphobia, both from strangers or from friends, from our families, even people that you love, even people who you wouldn't consider them to be transphobic. We can still say and have transphobic thoughts. And that's not even talking about internalized transphobia as well, to when the shame and gaslighting that transgender people experience comes from the outside, but then it starts to come from the inside as well. And that can create a lot of feelings of shame and wanting to not be who we are as transgender people. And so cope with that through cutting and through various other forms of self-harm, right? And so the transphobia and just negative attitudes towards transgender people, especially trans women of color, people of color experience, and trans people of lower socioeconomic class, of just less privilege in general, there's not a lot of places to talk about these intersections and how they manifest in a person and what they feel like. And so that can come out as self-harm.
You mentioned internalized thoughts related to this, and I don't know if this is relevant, but I have heard in some communities saying, like, well, if you're questioning your gender, God doesn't make mistakes. Like, how do you respond to that?
I respond to that, and I come from the perspective of a transgender person. And so I, in as much as a cisgender person doesn't understand what it's like to be transgender, I also don't really understand what it's like to be cisgender. And so to that, I would say that it is, I also am an atheist, so God does not necessarily come into my personal equation. But from my perspective, it's a very normal thing to question your gender because it is something that is a construct in the sense of something that we have created as people in order to express the sex that we align with, that we have inside of us. And so it is very normal to question whether your sex matches your gender, whether these two things line up in the way that you've been told that they line up. And it's also perfectly normal to come out of that thinking process and say, yeah, I think I'm good. I think my sex matches my gender. I'm all set to go. And so when people say, you know, God doesn't make mistakes, things like that, if God, and this is my own sentiment, if God created people in all of their diversity, in all of their variety, in all of their variability, he would also have created people who have these feelings, that they don't know where they came from. They don't know why they're having these feelings. They just are. And that's part of how God created them. There's a line that I'm just thinking of now that always brings me, and as much as I'm not a religious person, this particular line always brings me a lot of comfort. The line is, I don't remember the exact quote, but the sentiment is that God created wheat, but not bread, so that humans may participate in the act of creation, in the sense that he created people, but he allowed us to discover these parts of ourselves so that we can create ourselves along with God, so we can be an active participant in how we become ourselves and how we learn to love ourselves so that God can love us and we can love us. And I think that that's a really beautiful way of describing what it could mean to somebody to be transgender. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, and I imagine those that actually are born intersex might find comfort in that.
Absolutely. A lot of people say there's only two sexes, but that's also not true. There's like 7 different sexes if you consider intersex people and all the different ways that chromosomes can combine to make a person a human being, a thinking and feeling human being.
Well, if I might come back to your story a little bit. When you were 26, you started hormone replacement therapy, and prior to this, you had been self-injuring more frequently on your chest, hips, and those areas of your body. Some individuals do pursue surgical procedures, whether a mastectomy, so top surgery, and find utility with that. Is this something that you had also pursued? And if so, did it change any relationship with self-injury for you?
Yes, I did pursue those surgeries. I got top surgery, so a double mastectomy. And I also got a hysterectomy, so taking out my ovaries and such. I'm trying to think if that affected my relationship with self-harm. And I think it did, in the sense that I, for lack of a better way of putting it, I didn't have anywhere to self-harm anymore. And so those things that had been representing femininity were gone. They weren't there anymore. And now there was just a thin scar to represent something that had held so much, you know, meaning and heaviness for me. And so then I stopped self-harming in those places. Not to say that I stopped self-harming entirely, in the sense that I do still self-harm maybe like once or twice a year for unrelated reasons, but I stopped associating those parts of my body with something that I could self-harm onto, I guess you could say. To be perfectly honest, I don't really remember having any particular feelings or experiencing any noticeable changes in my self-harm because of these surgeries that I got. And it had lessened my gender dysphoria and my body dysphoria that I did have quite a lot. And so my self-esteem raised, my self-esteem got higher, and I felt better about being in my body. And so then that lessened my desire to self-harm in the first place. But when I did engage in self-harm, I don't really remember any particular changes to that dynamic, if that makes sense.
I was wondering if you had stopped self-injuring on your chest and hips as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I stopped self-harming on my chest. on the very once in a blue moon occasion where I did self-harm, it was not in those areas. I think that's a plus.
This must have been fairly recent, because if you're 31 now and you were 26 at the point where you accepted that part of your identity, really the past 5 years, I have two questions related to that. One is the concern that a lot of people have about long-term effects, how these kinds of medical procedures, hormone replacement therapy might affect you long-term, basically, if that would be helpful or harmful, and what your experience was with that. And two, would anything have changed if you had decided to do these things when you were younger?
That is a good question. So the first part, what you're asking is long-term consequences. Okay. Well, I've been on testosterone for, in June, it'll be 6 years. I personally don't, the only concern that I have about my own long-term health is that hormone replacement therapy for transgender people specifically won't be available anymore. There's hormone replacement therapy for cisgender people, but the hormone replacement therapy for transgender people is infamously always on the table. And to not have access to that, even, and it's even happening here in Canada as well, that there's this debate over whether we should allow transgender people to have access to hormone replacement therapy. For a lot of us transgender people, we've had these various surgeries to where we, the hormones that we have in our body are the ones that we're giving to ourselves, basically. And that is by design, by the system that we live in, and also by us as individuals. And so the only really long-term consequences that I'm concerned of are nothing to do with my health, nothing to do with my physical body. They're more to do with how my identity as a trans person is politicized and my access to healthcare is politicized. My concerns are that I won't have access to healthcare anymore after some event. I don't know what that would be. The only other thing that has been mentioned to me as a potential long-term effect of hormone replacement therapy as a trans person is kind of the same as what older women may experience, like osteoporosis, or how as we age, the level of hormones that we have in our body changes. Does that mean that I would have to change my dose for hormones or things like that? That's something that I don't think really has been researched at all. Whether should I still have the same amount of testosterone now that I'm when I'm 31 as opposed to when I'm 60 or something like that. Same for trans women, especially for trans women who are on estrogen, because those levels fluctuate all the time. Those are mostly my long-term concerns. In my own life, I'm very content with the decisions that I made at the time for when I made them. I think that if I had transitioned earlier, I would not have had the many of the experiences that make me who I am today. And I know a lot of trans people kind of look back on their past self, or they look back on their past life and they don't want to remember it because it was filled with so much pain. But for me personally, I have a lot of reverence or respect for my past self and my past experiences, because I don't hate those times in my life now anyway. I can recognize that those experiences made me who I am today, and it made me be able to be more empathetic towards people who maybe can't transition until later in life, or didn't realize that they were trans until later in life. I think that that's a very common experience, to transition somewhat later in life and to have kind of divide your life into pre-transition and post-transition. And I appreciate that I have those experiences, because it allows me to, I've been able to experience life as a woman and life as a man. And that's a really unique perspective to have. And I really appreciate that I can have that perspective. I think that if I had transitioned when I was younger, I would not be able to have as dynamic of an experience as I have. And I don't mean that to toot my own horn and be like, I know everything. But, you know, it's just really cool. And I know a few people who did transition when they were children, when they were teenagers, and they're also very happy with their decision, because their particular journey and their experience of being transgender told them that this is when they needed to transition. And for them, they have an entirely different experience of what it means to be trans and what it means to transition than I do. But both of these experiences are very valid, and they're very real, and they're very indicative of knowing ourselves as people.
I love hearing different perspectives, and I know you had given the caveat that this is your unique experience because everyone is different, including their experiences with self-injury. You have shared that you still self-injure maybe once or twice a year, much less frequent than when you were younger. What was helpful in decreasing your frequency and almost pretty much stopping self-injury for you?
I got a lot of therapy. That's probably the biggest one. And again, I feel very privileged to be able to have gotten the amount of therapy that I have been able to get. In Canada here, it's not the greatest healthcare system in the sense that it takes a long time to get healthcare and the quality of it can vary depending on where you go. But again, in my own experience, I felt very privileged that I was able to access really good quality mental health care for free. So that helped me work through all of the shame that had built up over 26 years of life. And at the time, I was also getting therapy for an eating disorder that I had as well. And so me and my therapist at the time kind of worked through all of that together in a very dedicated, systematic kind of way. Systematic in the sense that there was a series of steps that we went through. Yeah, and that helped me really be able to deal with the shame that I felt over just my own existence as a person. And that helped me be able to try to grow my toolbox of coping skills, so to speak. So I was able to add things like deep breathing or journaling or exercise or having really hard boundaries of when I'm working and when I'm not working, for example. So there was that. And there was also the volunteering for the same peer support groups that I was also participating in. That allowed me to feel like I had a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a reason to get up in the morning kind of deal. All of those things together helped me realize that I am more than my self-harm. I am more than just a person who cuts themselves. I have a reason for not self-harming. I have a reason to not self-harm. I think that was a really big point when I realized that, oh, if I continue self-harming, it'll get to a point where I might not be on this earth anymore, whether that would be like accidentally cutting too deep kind of deal. And that moment was a real moment where I was like, I need to do something to address this. I don't want to be 60 years old and still cutting myself. I have a reason to be here on this earth to not go away forever, so to speak. So that really helped me out too.
That really answered my next question, because I was wondering what about therapy or what intervention or strategy was most helpful. And it sounds like having something meaningful above and beyond self-injury and thinking even in the future, if this is what I want to be like in the future. And if not, let me do some volunteer work. Let me get active in my community and have reason to not self-injure.
Yeah. As a transgender adult, I would like to be a role model for transgender kids and transgender teens. And I want to be able to share this story of how I dealt with self-harm for many, many, many years. And at one point, I did think I'm going to be doing this the rest of my life. But that wasn't the case. Against all of my own beliefs, against what I expected to happen, that didn't happen. And I want to be that source of hope for maybe a trans teen who is in that same position that I was in when I was 16, to tell them that, and I know this phrase is thrown around a lot too, it gets better. And I know a lot of people say that in a like flippant, it'll get better, you'll be fine kind of deal. But really, it is true. And we do have it within ourselves to crawl out of those deep, dark holes that we were thrown into. Not that we went there ourselves, that we were thrown into, one little baby step at a time.
That's a great transition. As we come to a close, I really like that life gets better. And I think just hearing your story brings hope and is an example of that. There are adults that still self-injure. You're self-injuring as an adult, and they wonder if they're alone and if it can get better. And yeah, you're here to say it can. And it does.
Yeah. And that's not saying it'll be easy.
No.
It'll be hard, but it'll be worth it. And I think that's the take-home message, is that it'll be hard, but it'll be worth it. And it'll continue to be worth it. It's not a diminishing returns kind of deal.
Love it. So bringing everything together, your powerful story of lived experience and gender dysphoria, what would you recommend to parents?
As somebody who does not have kids, and I cannot imagine how hard it is to be in a position of being a parent to a child who self-injures, I would say that it's really important for parents to consistently reassure their child of the importance that their child has in their life, that through this process of healing, of going through these traumatic events, both for the parent and for the kid, through that confusion, through that fear, that y'all are on the same team. It's you two against this issue. It's not a parent against a child, even though it can feel like it sometimes, I'm sure. That it is you and your kid against this self-injury, against cutting, against whatever it happens to be. I really think that unconditional positive regard is really important here. I'm a big fan of Carl Rogers, and he has this concept called unconditional positive regard. And I think that that is essential to any kind of tackling of self-injury that a parent and their kid might have together. I think sometimes when people get really, really low on that self-esteem meter, they need a lot of gas in the tank to where the motor can turn over and they can kind of start to deal with their own problems themselves. Kids look to their parents for everything, right? For safety, for love, for affection, for food and a house and all things like that. And so if a parent can be that person to their kid, that if their kid can go to their parent and say, I don't know what to do. I'm really confused. And all I know is that things are really, really painful right now. They're looking to their parent to assure them that they're going to be okay. That even though there's a lot of confusion right now, y'all are going to work together and they don't have to deal with this by themselves.
Great recommendation, and love the shout out to Carl Rogers.
Yeah.
What would you recommend to professionals, clinicians, researchers?
And this particular part is just about being transgender. But I saw a meme recently that I think describes a common perspective that a lot of trans people might have. I don't know the person who made the meme. It's by some Tumblr user named Grumpy Pendant. But the quote, and I'll read the quote because I think it's a really good quote. It is, I think a lot of people have trouble understanding transgender issues because they try to see themselves as trans, but they come at it from the wrong direction. So for example, a cis woman tries to understand transness by going, what if I felt like, or what if I wanted to be a man? When really they should be approaching it as, what if I, a woman, was so easily mistaken for a man that I had to pretend to be one to get by in life? And I think that that really is a good way of describing what it can feel like to be trans and all the feelings that might come with what if I was so easily mistaken for a man kind of feelings. I think it's really important, and this may be both easier said than done and kind of common sense, but sometimes being reminded of things is nice too. I think it's really important to be open-minded towards trans clients or patients when they tell you what they need and what would help them. Things like maybe for kids or something, like a haircut or different clothes, or for, you know, older people, access to hormone replacement therapy or surgeries. I've been very lucky to have access to these services. It's done me a lot of good. And so I think for anybody who's working with trans people know what they need to feel good in their body. It's not just a flippant, oh, maybe I'll try testosterone for the rest of my life. We'll see what happens. No, it's usually I've thought a lot about this. This is something that I really do think will improve my life. This is something that I need in order to have a fulfilling life, to where I can contribute to things that are meaningful to me, to where I can have the energy to be a contributing member of society in whatever way that makes sense to that person. And so a trans patient or a client coming to you saying, hey, these are things that I want to do. The position of the doctor is not to say, no, you're not going to do these things. It's to say, okay, how can I help you in your goals? How can I help you with your health goals? And that's what the role is in those kinds of situations. And it's not like you have to have all the answers. It's okay to say, I don't really know how to help you here. I don't know what my role is in this kind of care for you. But I think the important part is that you cannot know what to do, but still want to support your client or your patient in their goals in whatever way that looks, whether it's referring to somebody else who does know how to provide gender-affirming care, or educating yourself on how to provide gender-affirming care for your field. There are lots of guides out there. There are lots of people whose work is dedicated towards teaching other people how to provide gender-affirming care. If you want to be a person who is supportive of your trans clients and supportive of your trans patients, there are certain steps you can take to do that. It's just a matter of doing them. And again, I'm not a professional in this regard. Hopefully one day I will be, but I'm not a professional in this regard. And so there may be difficulties or caveats in the way of achieving those goals that you have with your trans clients, but they are doable. There are resources out there if you need them.
And what would you recommend to people with lived experience of self-injury?
I guess I just want to put a message out there, so to speak, for individuals who also self-injure. In my mind, there is no moral value to self-injury in the sense that it is a coping skill among many, many coping skills. And all of them fall somewhere along this spectrum of beneficial to harmful. And it has zero bearing on your quality of yourself as a person, or the goodness or worthiness or love that we deserve as thinking and feeling sentient human beings. There's a false association there that self-injury or cutting is associated with your quality of your character, but it is not in any sense of the word. I think that we as humans are way too complicated and overwhelmingly dynamic to really be boxed into these categories of entirely good or entirely bad, or even entirely male or entirely female. Every single day, we're finding new ways that people are complicated and weird and not at all like what we've been taught, you know? And so I've personally found a lot of power in owning the fact that I'm a messy, disappointing person who's just trying their best to be a good person to myself and to other people. And I think that for people who do self-injure, perhaps some of their reason for self-injuring comes from the fact that they think they're a bad person, or they think that they're not worthy of respect or worthy of love, or that the bad things that happen to them are their own fault. I know that was something that I thought for a very long time, was that the bad things that happen to me are my fault. But that is not true. We are all inherently worthy of love and respect and appreciation and kindness just because we are people, not because of anything that we've done or not done. So that's the message that I would give to other people who self-harm as well, is that I know it's hard to believe, and I know it takes time to really believe that about yourself, but you are a good and worthy person who does deserve to be loved, who does deserve all the good things that happen to you, to us, in our lives. And I hope that one day we can all kind of embrace that sense that it's okay to make mistakes, it's okay to fumble, it's okay to be a messy, disappointing person. And it doesn't mean that you're any less of a person in that regard.
What a great, hopeful, positive message. There are so many angles we could have taken today. I know you mentioned eating disorder. We could have talked about that, your parents. But I really like just focusing on your experience with gender dysphoria, self-injury, and the hopeful message that you've shared. And I know I asked some really personal questions, so thanks for being open, because I know it's out there in the public now once we release this episode. So Thomas, thank you for sharing such important story. I can't wait to see your work in the future. Hopefully you do become a psychologist and are able to contribute to this field. I know we'll all benefit as a result.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Psychology of Self-Injury podcast. If you have found this podcast helpful and would like to give back, please subscribe and please help others find us by giving us a 5-star rating, writing a positive review, and or telling your friends and colleagues. If you'd like to interact with us, we welcome you to respond to our questions and polls under each episode in Spotify. This podcast is not considered therapy or meant to be a replacement for therapy, so if you or someone you love is in crisis and needs to talk to someone, you can reach out to the Crisis Text Line, a global not-for-profit organization providing free mental health texting service through confidential crisis intervention, by texting HOME to 741-741. For all things psychology, follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Doc Westers. For all things self-injury, follow ISSS on Facebook and Twitter at ITRIPLES. I'm Dr. Nicholas Westers. Thank you for listening to the Psychology of Self-Injury.